Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from Relator in R.K. versus Ramirez.
May I please report? Mr. Ramirez, I'm going to present argument for Relator. Relator is your opinion.
My name is Rosemary Holland. It is a true fact, and I represent Dr. Kling, who's the relator in this case. This is a very important issue, and I think the court recognizes that, and that's why I'm here today. Dr. Kling is complaining of a trial court order which compelled him to disclose mental health records in an underlying medical malpractice case. The trial court's order was based upon an exception to Rule 510 in the Rules of Evidence. And it is our position in this case that the trial court's order based upon that exception is invalid, and we're requesting the court to vacate that court's order. As I said, the case is a medical malpractice case in which five doctors are being sued for medical malpractice. The specific allegations are very important for the court to understand. The specific allegations are that three of those treating physicians, of which Dr. Kling was only one, each of those doctors failed to diagnose twins, which the plaintiffs alleged led to one of those twins developing cerebral palsy at birth. Another thing the court needs to understand is that this case arose in 1984, the occurrence did. The plaintiffs have said in their petition before the court that the relevant time period is from May of 1984 until October of 1984. This was the time period during which the defendant physicians were taking care of Maria Cadena, the real party of interest, during her prenatal care. Another cause of action in the underlying suit is a case for negligent credentialing that the plaintiffs have ran against the hospital and the clinic which employed the physicians. And that is really why the reason why we're here today. As I want to stress, Dr. Kling was only one of the three treating physicians who have alleged negligently diagnosed the presence of twins leading to damages. The other two physicians were his superiors. There are multiple issues addressed in all the briefs and supplemental briefs which I will not be able to address here today just due to time constraints. But I think that I can say that our position is fourfold. Number one, due to the importance of this privilege against the compelled disclosure of confidential communications made to mental health professionals, the D5 exception was interpreted overbroadly by the trial court, and the exception should be construed to be limited only to the offensive use privilege following the test that was laid out by this court in the Republic Insurance v. Davis case, which was actually an attorney-client privilege case, but which we submit to this court due to the important objectives sought to be obtained by this privilege, that they are analogous and the same test should be applied. Our second point is that the exception is overbroad and it violates Dr. Kling's right to privacy as guarded by the state and federal constitutions. Thirdly, the D5 exception, regardless of its interpretation broadly by the trial court, narrowly as we urge, cannot be construed to ever permit abusive discovery simply based upon insupportable claims that a party's condition is a part of their claim, which we think in advance of this court is what is going on in this case. And our fourth point is finally, the 1998 amendment to subsection D5. 1988 amendment to subsection D5 of Rule 10 cannot, under any circumstances, be applied retroactively so as to limit or destroy Dr. Kling's vested right to confidential communications with healthcare providers, which were attached at the time the communications were made and the in-camera documents prove that all those communications occurred before the 1988 amendment. Going back to point number one, that the D5 exception is overbroad. Right now, this exception, as interpreted by the trial court, and if interpreted literally, swallows the entire privilege. It allows the discovery of a non-party's mental health communications. And here, for example, Dr. Kling is a party. The plaintiffs don't claim to this court or at all that these communications would ever be relevant in the underlying negligence case against him, but instead they assert their right to waive Dr. Kling's privilege so that they can support a claim against the hospital co-defendant. Taking that same line of reasoning a step further, and if you follow their line of reasoning, the plaintiffs could further amend their pleadings in this case and claim that Perhaps this hospital has a history of negligent credentialing, and perhaps if there are any other staff physicians on that hospital staff who've ever been treated, that they're entitled to see their mental health records too. Certainly, this is not the court's intent, nor the intent of the legislature, to obtain these types of results. And I say it's certainly so, based upon a common sense interpretation of the rule and the privilege, and reminding myself that that rule mustn't be interpreted by the Code Construction Act, and upon a considered examination of the interests which are sought to be obtained by the privilege.
Is this an ancient and honorable privilege?
I do believe so. I do believe that perhaps due to the nature of the fact that psychotherapy is a relatively quote-unquote new science, I think it's ancient and honorable and more similar to the penitent or the preacher analogy as pointed out in one of the briefs, that perhaps before psychotherapists even came into existence, the preacher served that same purpose. And I think that that's a good analogy. You could substitute that in.
How can this privilege be in any way classified as ancient when it was not, it was unknown in Texas law until 1979 and unknown in federal court?
Okay, when he said ancient, I guess I was construing that kind of figuratively speaking. I was thinking that...
Well, you talk about the broad purposes of this privilege make it such that it couldn't be read literally.
Right.
And I was really just asking, Justice Gonzalez asked it better than I did, but think about the purposes. How long has it been around? If it didn't exist at all 20 years ago, why can't it be written so narrowly that it has very little scope?
Well, it's my understanding the privilege first came into existence in 1979 under the old revised statutes, and that contained no exceptions such as the one here, and it was codified when the rules of evidence were codified in 1983. So I didn't mean to misstate that I thought it was ancient in the sense that it was, time immemorial. However, if it isn't ancient, it ought to have been. And if you look to Professor Duke's treatise, and he's one of the persons who signed their brief, he states that it was only after decades of withering criticism by many numerous commentators that Texas finally shamed itself into adopting a privilege. So I think that the reasons for having a privilege existed for a long time, and that unfortunately we were just slow in catching up to realize the importance of that privilege and, giving it the force of law.
On your second point, if offensive use is the only time these privileges are waived, then how, if ever, can a plaintiff ever get this information?
Well, that's why I suggested to the court that obviously we're not taking, I think, the position that under no circumstances could the privilege ever give way. Obviously, in a voluntary situation, it could give way. If the plaintiffs in this case needed to make a negligent credentialing case with the hospital, they certainly wouldn't need these documents to do that. If, in fact, the guy was impaired at the time, if they feel that they have enough evidence that they can place them in their pleading, then I would think there are other ways that they could prove their point about the impairment. So they don't need to go into these confidential, deep, dark documents to prove their point. Not only that, but in this particular case, those documents weren't even in existence at the time of the occurrence. They didn't come into existence until after Maria Cadena was delivered as a twin. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
The objectives, like I said, sought to be obtained are to facilitate the rendition of mental health treatment and to protect disclosure of one's deepest, darkest thoughts, feelings, etc., which I think we all recognize, if they were disclosed, would expose one to alienation, ridicule, and discrimination. And about that, one of the only things that I agree with in Dr. Good's treatise is his recognition of the onus our society continues to associate with mental health care. And I would suggest to the court that it has been out of this onus and at long last that the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed recently. So how does this privilege accomplish these objectives? Well, obviously by securing to the patient that their confidential communications will not be disclosed.
Do you concede that if these documents, which the credentialing committee of the hospital, if they had predated this delivery, and there was some evidence that the psychiatric or psychological condition that the doctor had served as notice to the hospital that they perhaps should not credential this doctor, you can see that they'd be discoverable under those circumstances?
Well, no, because then they'd be subjected to the peer review committee documents it. And I think that you can't say he would have waived his privilege in that circumstance because he can waive his privilege for the limited purpose of obtaining privileges without waiving it forever and for all things.
So even if the doctor was demonstrably impaired and there was evidence that the hospital credentialing committee had that he was impaired, but they nevertheless granted him credentials, there's just no way a plaintiff can get to those records to prove their case?
Well, my understanding of peer review statutes would lead to that result. Now, you're asking
because
as
of
a privacy
privilege.
Matter? Yeah, as a privacy matter, I would say that he would have waived it because he had voluntarily submitted it to the hospital for their consideration. In essence, he'd say, I waive it to this degree so that I may obtain this privilege to work at your hospital, but that's not what happened to him. I think it's clear to the court, and I don't mean to state things that are obvious, but it seems that no one would speak frankly if they feared exposure, nullifying all hopes of effective treatment. So what does society lose if mental health services and treatment aren't received, they aren't effective? Well, it loses hardworking citizens, it loses parents, children, teachers, voters, it loses souls. And no one can disagree that effective mental health evaluation and treatment is an object that a civilized society ought to encourage and protect. And this case exemplifies how the overbroad interpretation of D-5 defeats the purposes of the privilege and seeks to expose to society the individual who relied on that privilege. At least four courts of appeals that are cited in the brief have struggled to give a valid interpretation to D-5. They have, for the most part, held that D-5 is limited to situations where the patient puts his own condition in issue. Well, it's uncontroverted that Dr. Swing is not putting any condition that's contained in the in-camera documents at issue in this case.
If the doctor had some other debilitating physical condition that did affect his work, such as epilepsy or some neurological dysfunction, wouldn't that be relevant both in the credentialing process and also in a plaintiff's lawsuit who claims that that affected the performance of a particular case and that the hospital should have known that?
Be relevant with credentialing. Well, like I said, if they'd asked, the hospital had been under a duty to ask, and they had asked in a credentialing thing, and Dr. Kling had offered that information, I guess one position could have taken is, I don't want to give you that information because I just won't work at your hospital.
My question, though, is you paint a picture of mental health as being unusually sensitive. But if it were not something like that, if it were just a physical problem that the doctor had, would you be, those arguments don't work.
I agree. I think a distinction should be made between the regular physician-patient and the psychotherapist patient privileges. I think the psychotherapist privilege is entitled to much greater weight and protection. And I think that you would have a hard time claiming that the attorney-client privilege should outweigh the psychotherapist patient privilege. The rendition of legal service is important, but the rendition of health services, to me, would be even more important. Our second point is that the D-5
acceptance... Your time has expired. Do you want to invade your rebuttal time?
No, I think I'll go ahead and wait.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Okay, please support Mr. Richard Franklin.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Frankel, along with my partner Dick Miller. We do represent the Cadena family in this medical malpractice case that Ms. Holland told you a little bit about. Danny Cadena is a severely handicapped 9-year-old who lives down in McAllen, and this lawsuit's brought on his behalf by his parents. What you have just heard is a clever argument that this court should disregard its own rules for policy purposes. There wasn't any attempt to point the court to the rules that are the applicable rules and explain why those rules do not apply. Instead, the argument was the rules can't mean what they say because it would be bad policy if they meant that. In her brief, in the petitioner's brief, they basically make three arguments. One, the rules don't mean what they say. Two, the court couldn't have meant what it said because of policy reasons. And three, if it really meant what it said and the rules mean what they say, you've acted unconstitutionally in 1988 when you adopted these amendments. None of those three arguments have any weight at all. They are just dead wrong.
Is it your position that a mere claim of relevancy to this information entitles you to this information?
No, Your Honor. The test that's set out in the Court of Appeals opinion, I think, is the applicable test. The rule talks about two different things. One, there has to be a condition that's at issue, and the documents or communications have to be relevant to that condition. In this case, Dr. Kling's condition, his medical records pertain to his mental or physical condition. So that first part of the rule, the relevancy between the communications and his condition, is satisfied. The second thing is that there has to be any party, not just the patient, but any party is what the rule says, relying on the patient's condition as a part of their claim. And what that state means to me, and the Court of Appeals said below, if there is an allegation, how do you determine whether a party is relying on a patient's condition as part of their claim? You look at the pleadings. There's no evidentiary way to prove what a party is relying on other than to look at the pleadings. In this case, we actually had one better than that because Judge Ramirez, at the request of petitioners, reviewed the documents himself to convince himself that we weren't on a fishing expedition and that the documents that he reviewed, the mental health records he reviewed, did have some relationship to the allegations contained in our petition.
But in fact, you say that was just, he was just doing that for lack of anything better to do with his time.
But no.
Once it's in a pleading, you get it.
Well, they have rights under 166B, protective order rights, and they exercise those rights and argue for a protective order, and under that rule, they have a right to submit the documents in camera. They did that. The judge reviewed those documents and made an implicit finding, although not an explicit one, in his order to compel that those documents had a relationship to the allegations that we had made.
How is a doctor's medical history or psychiatric history in any way relevant to whether or not he performed in a negligent manner that approximately caused the injuries to his baby?
The issue that is most relevant to is the decision by the hospital and the clinic who credentialed him, actually didn't credential him, permitted him to work in their residency program. He was not a credentialed doctor. He was a resident that had to be supervised because he was unlicensed. But they made a decision in 1983 and renewed that decision in 1984 to let him in their program. They had a duty to investigate his background and find out whether he was qualified
and,
enough.
I understand that as to the hospital, but as to the doctor himself, you know, who cares whether or not he had at some point interpersonal relationship problems with colleagues or spouse or other human beings?
It certainly would depend on the kind of problem that he had, but for example, if he was hospitalized because he had a drug problem, that may reflect on whether he had a drug problem on the day in question. It would depend on the circumstances, and frankly, we haven't seen the documents, so we're not sure just precisely what his problem was. We know it was a severe problem because he was in a hospital for over a month. And I should address at this point the timing issue, because Ms. Holland said, well, since the care was provided from May of 1984 until this little boy was born in October of 1984, records of a hospitalization in January of 1985 couldn't conceivably have anything to do with this case. I think all of you know that those kind of documents, and particularly a disability as serious as one where you're in a hospital for a month, probably will show a long-standing problem. That's my bet, and certainly it is more probable than not that something in those documents is going to be relevant to say what his condition was the preceding 3 or 4 months.
Does your right to this information depend on the lawsuit against the hospital, or are you contending that if you were suing the doctor, only the doctor, that you're entitled to this information?
Well, I think it would depend on our allegations. In this case, we have alleged, based on the information we have, that Dr. Kling was unfit on the day in question, or the period of time, actually. He provided care on and off from May of 1984 to October 1984. If he was impaired during that period, for example, when he was reading ultrasounds and missed that there were two babies on an ultrasound, he was impaired during that period, it would go to his negligence in undertaking to provide medical services when he knew that he was not capable of doing so.
So you would be entitled in an automobile accident case, if you represent the plaintiff, to the defendant's mental health record to show that they might be impaired during the time that they were operating their motor vehicle?
You would need to show the two elements of Rule 509D5. You'd need to show that there was relevancy between the mental health records you were seeking and the patient's condition. And number two, you would have to show a connection between that party's claim and the condition. I mean, if the person reeked of alcohol when you got out of the car, then you probably could get to those records.
What is the connection here with regards to negligence?
Well, with regard to the negligence against the doctor or...
Against the doctor.
We don't know until we see the records. I mean, we are alleging that if he had a long-standing problem, which we believe is the case, then it certainly could have impaired his condition. We know of several negligent acts that he either omitted, acts or omissions that occurred while he was caring for this woman, some very basic things.
The question was, though, could you always get it? And the answer was, only if you show these two things.
Yes.
And then the question is, have you shown those two things? And the answer is, no, not yet, because we haven't seen the doctor.
We have not shown them as only to the doctor. I mean, I think that we have shown through information to the judge other information that we learned in discovery about this doctor's problems that include the fact that in October of 1984, that he had supervision and he had monthly reports that his supervisors had to give talking about how well he was doing. In October of 1984, when this incident occurred, no report exists. November 1984, the report says he admits that because of personal problems, he's not doing well. In December of 1984, he says, the supervisor says, I can't evaluate him. He only came three times. January 85 to March of 85, he's out of the program and was presumably in a mental health institute.
Have you taken the deposition of those supervisors?
We only have their reports. The answer is no, we haven't. We have frankly.
Why couldn't you find out the information you want from those sources as opposed to the mental health records themselves?
Well, the supervisors could speak to what they observed. But somebody who says I can't evaluate him because I only observed him three times, I don't think would be very helpful to us in
what
his
position. Could you ask why are you supervising Dr. Kling? And they could say, well, I know, and this is the reason. They could say, I don't know.
No, in case it wasn't clear, the supervision was because he's an unlicensed doctor and under law is not permitted to practice medicine without supervision. The supervision didn't have to do with the fact that he may have had problems. And in fact, I believe the facts are going to show he wasn't supervised at all. But he did get these monthly reports that provided some of the information to us that we're not on some fishing expedition. Judge Ramirez, when he reviewed these records, implicitly made that determination. And I know Justice Gonzalez, when he wrote the Ginsburg opinion, the same concerns were raised. And in that case, the relationship between the woman's mental health records and the facts were, I think, even more tangential than these. And somebody argued, well, adopting an offensive use exception to the privilege is just opening up a Pandora's box, and the response was, no, it's not. We have rules for protective orders. The trial court conducted an in-camera review and satisfied itself that this wasn't a fishing expedition, that there was legitimacy in seeking out this information, and that's precisely what's happened here, and I think that alleviates these concerns of wild fishing expeditions.
Let me ask a question. You are still mean, do you accept that in this case, you're still going to have to show negligence in the care and treatment of the mother in this case? Will you not?
We do.
Do you concede that if you fail to show negligence in the care and treatment, that the mere showing that he is mentally impaired won't get you there?
Correct. I think that on the proximate cause issue, if nothing else, where there has to be a connection between a problem and what caused the damage to this baby.
Now, in your interpretation of this exception, if there is a car accident, you would be entitled to the mental health records of the driver of the other car by simply claiming that they were mentally impaired. I mean, in any negligent action, under your interpretation of this exception, you would be entitled to the mental health records of the party you're suing, because you could always simply allege that there was a reason why they were distracted and the accident occurred. And see, my point is, they swerved across the mid-stripe of the highway. That was the act of negligence. We therefore want their mental records to assess if there was a mental reason for why they're negligent.
Well, I'll give you, I think the answer is yes, if there are mental records and you have some basis for making that allegation. That's precisely, in fact, in this case.
You're kind of begging the question. You wouldn't have to have a basis for making the allegation. All you'd have to allege is you're interested in the reason why they were distracted.
All right, and then the trial court would look at the documents, and if there were any mental health records, and the documents had no relationship and involved, you know, an alcohol problem that had been solved 10 years earlier, or whatever documents, whatever subjects they might relate to, then a protective order could be issued by the court making a determination that there is no connection between the patient's condition and the claims asserted by the party who's seeking the documents. In fact, that is what
is it relevant in a negligence action to know the reason why someone was negligent if they don't contend, if the defendant doesn't contend this is an unavoidable accident, or if the defendant doesn't contend that things happen not subject to my control, like a seizure or something that happens in non-anticipated, unless the defendant raises some cause for their distraction as a defense, is it relevant in a negligence action why the doctor was negligent, or why the driver of the car was negligent?
Certainly might be. It might be relevant to gross negligence. If a doctor went in drunk as a skunk and performed surgery, that'd be a different, and he screwed up, it'd be a different situation than if he just went in and made a mistake and was negligent. It'd make a big difference.
Well, the
situation that presents itself in this case, ironically enough, is that Ms. Holland did precisely what you're suggesting. My client is a 7 or 9 year old boy. What she was looking for was an explanation for why that boy was damaged when he was born. And so what she did was she went out and rummaged through my client's mother's medical records for 5 or 10 years, saying maybe there's something in there. And nobody objected because it clearly was permitted under the rules. And it happens every day in practice. That's what goes on, whether it's on the defense side or the plaintiff side. But under the rules, as she wants to interpret them, Mrs. Cadena, the mother, was not putting her condition at issue in this case. She's not even a party to the case.
You don't see any relevance between the physical health of the parents in line of the birth of the child relevant to the child's physical condition?
Well, there may be some relevance. That's why I'm saying I think it's fair game under the rules. Just as I believe in this case, especially when there's a close proximity in time to Dr. Kling's disabilities, his mental health problems, and some clear acts of negligence, and particularly on the negligent entrustment case. I think, as Justice Cornyn mentioned, I don't know how else you go about trying to prove these things except to try to prove what they didn't investigate. And the only way the starting point is, what problems did this doctor have that they should have found out about? Whether they be criminal problems, whether they be disabilities for health or physical reasons, mental problems. In this particular case, I think if they had investigated this doctor, they would have found all of those, but they didn't investigate. And that's just a classic negligent entrustment case. I think the bottom line on all of this is whether this court is going to follow the rule as it's written. If you look at 510D5, it's written in plain English, as they say, and it says that there is an exception as to a communication or record relevant to an issue of physical, mental, or emotional condition of a patient in any proceeding in which any party relies upon the condition as a part of the party's claim of defense. Any party, that was a change from the 1984 amendment that made a distinction between living and deceased patients. And with living patients, only if you were putting your condition at issue was there an exception to this privilege. But this court in 1988 changed that. And to adopt the argument made by Ms. Holland would be to say that the 88 amendment was meaningless. And not only did you change it, you changed the corresponding rule to 509D4 dealing with medical health records so that it too now reads identical to 510D5. The courts that have gone the other way in Houston and in Dallas have misinterpreted Justice Gonzalez's opinion in Ginsburg, an opinion that narrowed the scope of the privilege, that said in instances where the exception does not apply, and no one's expressly waived, there may still be circumstances in which the evidence is discoverable. And in that case, adopting an offensive use doctrine, this court ruled that certain mental health communications were discoverable. And they took that and somehow engrafted a doctrine that was intended to narrow the privilege and made it into, or tried to engraft it into the rule, even though there's nothing in the rule that says that, so that the exception of the privilege now, in the words of the 14th Court of Appeal, require offensive use. There's just frankly nothing in the rule that supports that, and in fact, the history of the rule goes just the other way. There was such an offensive use requirement written in the rule in 1984. This court changed the rule in 1988 and changed it so that if any party relies, not just the patient.
Just so I'm clear, in any negligence case, then, the mental health of the defendant is in issue.
Or it could be the mental health of the plaintiff is in issue, too. This is not a plaintiff-defendant issue.
So the answer is, we're talking about plaintiffs seeking documents from a defendant here.
Yes.
But your contention is that in any negligence case, whether it be malpractice or automobile accident, the mental health of the defendant is in issue.
No, only if it's alleged to be an issue. I don't think that most people
Anytime it's alleged to be an issue without any other showing being required, then it is an issue for purposes of discovery.
And then Rule 166B, I think, would be the appropriate mechanism for a defendant to seek protection and say, review the documents. While I went to a psychiatrist 15 years ago, it has absolutely nothing to do with the automobile accident that happened last week. That's how I suggest that you deal with that. I think the same issue comes up all the time in life insurance disputes, where the insurance company in a life insurance beneficiary case says, I think it was a suicide. We're not paying. And the beneficiary says, well, my condition's not an issue. And they say, well, we want to see whether there are some medical records or mental health records that would make it more likely than that this deceased committed suicide, and they get those records under this rule. It's the only way they can go about trying, or one way they can go about trying to prove a suicide case. So it comes up on both sides of the bar. It's not a peculiar, strangely enough, the reported opinions seem to be medical malpractice cases with doctors that have cocaine problems. In everyday practice, this issue comes up day after day, but on both sides of the bar.
What is the basis of your allegation of the Dr. Kling's mental health problem that
you expect these records to illuminate?
We believe that he had, I'm not sure that I understand what you mean by basis.
What's the basis of your pleading that puts his mental health records in issue?
We believe, based on some of the supervisory records that I mentioned, based on the fact that he was kicked out of a prior residency program in 1980 in Chicago, based on the fact that from 1980 to 1983 when he came to McAllen, he was an antique salesman and couldn't get a job, based on the fact that he failed his national boards during that period four times, that he must have had some serious problems, whether they were drug-related, mental health problems. He was in an institute for over a month, and that's not a casual type problem, and it happens to correspond with some very gross acts of negligence that was committed on my client.
Counsel, let me ask you to take off your counsel hat for a minute. Put on testifying to the body that writes rules. Rule 505 and 510 protect us to some degree the same type of communication as opposing counsel has pointed out, and yet they are set up in a vastly different way. Which is preferable public policy when it comes time for us to rewrite the rules of evidence? The essentially absolute privilege under 505 or the privilege that really protects only against the grossest of fishing expeditions under 510?
Well, I really do believe 510 in conjunction with 166C deals with fishing expeditions, but as the court recognized, this is a brand new privilege that I think quickly was eviscerated by the wisdom of this court. I mean, in criminal courts, I think the rule lasted 2 years.
Well, should it be eviscerated in 505? I mean, is this a privilege that just doesn't need to exist? I mean, the social harm it caused it. Greatly outweighs its utility.
I don't believe that, and I believe that there are certainly situations, many situations, where this exception would not apply, even in civil litigation. The Ginsburg case is a perfect example. Under that case, under the facts of that case, this privilege would protect that communication. That's why you'd have to go to the offensive use doctrine as a waiver or implied waiver doctrine to get the information. You can't just rummage through somebody's psychiatric records thinking that maybe they told a psychiatrist one time something that's relevant to the case, which is really what was going on in Ginsburg. But the rules and the objectives of getting to the truth in lawsuits, as the opinion in the Chapman case in Dallas says, I mean, it's a license for somebody to lie or to say, I don't remember, if they know you can't get behind it and can't ask anybody who was there or can't see the records that would contradict them.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I think that after hearing counsel's presentation, I think counsel has conceded that you can't just go rummaging through records in hopes of finding something that supports your case. Once again, that is one of the basis and a very important part of my proceeding here today. In my opinion, I think the record before this court evidences by the plaintiff's own Fifth Amendment petition. If you read these allegations carefully, you will see that the plaintiff does not have any genuine claim that my client, Dr. Kling's condition, is a part of their case. I mentioned it briefly at the outset that the underlying allegations, specific allegations of negligence here, are the failure to diagnose Quinn. Counsel also recognized that to prove his case against the hospital, he'd have to show how an impairment caused that negligent diagnosis and how that negligent diagnosis led to the damages. So he's in essence admitted that there is no nexus, is what I've always argued. There has to be a nexus between the alleged impairment and the negligence that occurred. And if you look at the Fifth Amendment petition, now he states in his answer before this court that Dr. Kling performed two ultrasounds, which we know those are tests to diagnose children, you know, babies in utero. However, in his petition, and in Maria Cadena, who is the mother, deposition excerpts before this court, she stated under oath that Dr. Kling did not even perform the first ultrasound. And in the petition, counsel alleges that Kling, Maynard, and Beal, three different doctors, the other two of whom have never alleged to be impaired under any circumstances, diagnosed and treated her, and a determination was made by these defendants based upon repeated physical examinations and the results of an ultrasound, the first one being in June of 1984, done only one child was she was carrying. And then October 10th, 1984, Mrs. Cadena had another ultrasound test, and I'm reading from, paraphrasing from the plaintiff's petition, was misinterpreted by defendants Kling and Beal. Now, Dr. Beal's not alleged to have been impaired during any relevant time. And they also say that defendants Kling and Beal diagnosed Ms. Cadena was carrying one child. They and their colleagues also diagnosed and so on and so forth. The basic crux of their whole entire petition and the underlying cause here is a failure to diagnose twins. So the records show here that this is what I call a specious claim, that it's part of their claim against the hospital, because they, their own pleading admits that there is no nexus between this alleged impairment, which we did not exist at the time, by the way, and the negligence that occurred in this case. In addition, with respect to the plaintiff's claim, they need this information. Because they're trying to say the hospital knew or should have known of Dr. Kling's impaired condition. In-camera documents themselves, once again, prove conclusively the documents were not in existence and therefore could not have been available in any hypothetical situation to the hospital in 1983 when they determined that Dr. Kling could see patients at the hospital. Once again, the plaintiff's petition in paragraph 8 is chock full of character assassinations of Dr. Kling, and I would suggest to you that we disagree and dispute all of those character allegations, but once again, I would point out to the court that even if true, which we deny, that these, quote, character flaws, there's nothing in there to say how these character flaws, how these character flaws of his past somehow caused his co-defendants, Drs. Maynard and Beal, to fail to diagnose twins, which is the exact same allegations that he has against my client. So I'm saying that regardless of how D-5 is read by this court, it's got to protect against this type of situation, which is, in essence, a specious claim, fishing expedition. And then last but not least, I need to stress something. This case arose in, it arose out of an occurrence of the birth of children October 11, 1984. There was a different amendment in place at that time, which clearly would not have allowed the disclosure of these confidential communications. Then in 1988, it's the one we're all talking and debating about here today, a different rule was passed. And it's my contention that under Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution, the passage of retroactive laws is prohibited. And that Dr. Kling got a vested right to the confidentiality of those communications at the time he made them, and the records show when that was. But the fact is, it was all before 1988 when the rule was changed. And I do have some citations on that to support that theory, which is not in any of the briefs so far before the court. I submit those to the court at their request. Does the court have any other questions?
Would you please submit those by way of brief?
Yes, I will.
On the next Monday.
Does the court have any other questions of you?
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the second cause, the court will then take another brief recess.
The audience will please rise.